This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, October 8th. From KBCS in Bellevue, Seattle, I'm Yuko Kadama. The Iraq Investigation Committee reports that the actions of Blackwater on September 16th were deliberate and recommended prosecution of those responsible. A federal court prevents the Social Security Administration from sending down 140,000 letters to employers over false or mistaken Social Security accounts. And a protest takes place in Colorado against the Columbus Day celebrations. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has announced plans to cut British troop levels in Iraq to 2,500 by next spring. Today's announcement coincides with criticism from some members of parliament for Brown's refusal to call an early election. Iraq's president has come out in favor of a U.S.-backed plan to divide the country into three parts. Hiba Dawood has more.
Iraqi President Jalal Talabani has made public statement in support of a U.S. Senate proposal to divide Iraq into three different regions under the control of a central government with limited powers. The plan would give control of the south to the Shiite majority there, the Sunnis would have the western part of the country, and the Kurds would continue to rule the north in the area already recognized as Iraqi Kurdistan. The division plan calls on the central government to administer the distribution of Iraq's important oil revenue and to provide national security for the three regions. The Iraqi president, who is a Kurd, says that dividing the country into three regions would prevent civil war between Sunnis, Shias, and the Kurds. Talabani also says that the division would not threaten Iraqi unity, an opinion that few Iraqis share. For FSRN, I'm Hiba Dawood reporting.
The Department of Health and Human Services recently levied the largest fine in its history against the University of California as manager of the Lawrence Livermore National Lab, for mishandling anthrax. Kelly Ramirez has the story.
An uninspected package of vials shipped to a lab in Florida in September 2005 had two open vials and a third with a loose cap. Two workers at the Florida lab were exposed to anthrax when they opened the package. They were treated with the antibiotic Cipro for a week, then returned to work. A second shipment, sent to Virginia, contained more vials than the allowed maximum limit. The shipments were not inspected, and the credentials of the person sending them had expired. Robert Schwartz, staff attorney for Tri-Valley Cares, a Lawrence Livermore watchdog organization, offered his take on why the fine is so large.
We're talking about a release of anthrax. This is a very serious incident. And the lab itself had a track history of certain level of accidents and things of this nature, so I think they wanted to send a really strong signal.
Tri-Valley Cares is filing Freedom of Information Act requests to find out more about the incidents, including whether live or dead anthrax was involved. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
The transitional Somali government has signed a comprehensive agreement with the elders of the main opposition clan after months of stalemate. Abdulrahman Warsame reports from Mogadishu.
The agreement contains three main points. One, the cessation of hostilities between insurgents and Somali government and Ethiopian troops. Two, the removal of military bases in civilian areas. And three, permission for thousands of displaced persons to return to their homes in the capital. Elders of the dominant Hawiye clan have opposed the presence of Ethiopian troops on Somali government policies. It is unclear if Islamic insurgents who have been waging an ongoing guerrilla war will respect the agreement signed today between clan elders and the government. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Abdulrahman Warsame in Mogadishu.
Costa Ricans appear to have passed a measure to sign a free trade agreement with the United States, but the opposition has demanded a manual recount. Nan McCurdy has more on the story.
President Oscar Arias, who supports the deal, declared victory once preliminary results indicated a slight lead for the yes vote. Leaders of the movement against the trade deal refused to recognize the results until after a manual vote count scheduled to begin on Tuesday. Costa Rica is the only country that has not ratified DR-CAFTA, the free trade deal between five Central American countries, the Dominican Republic, and the United States. Critics of the trade deal fear an avalanche of cheap subsidized grains from the United States, as well as possible privatization of public sector services, will compromise the quality of life in the only Central American country with a large middle class. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nan McCurdy.
And those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
An Iraqi investigation committee today found that Blackwater security bodyguards to State Department officials were criminally liable during a free-fire melee that occurred September 16th. The committee recommended prosecution of those responsible for the deaths. I spoke with Doug Brooks, president of the International Peace Operations Association, an umbrella group of private military contractors, including Blackwater, about the oversight of contracted firms. Why use private military corporations?
Because these companies, these private companies, provide, surge capacity, first of all. I mean, any military, even the U.S. military, needs to expand in certain areas, in engineering, in aviation, in logistics, in training, all sorts of things that it doesn't normally keep within its own ranks. And so they need to go out to the private sector to get these kinds of services. Our industry comes from around the world. You can get an engineer from India who you can pay two or three times their national salary, and they're still cheaper than an American, for example. So you can get a real economy out of that and an incredible expertise.
Okay, and who has the congressional oversight?
I think we counted up at one point 15 different committees and subcommittees that do the oversight. There's a lot of it. There's a lot of hearings on the industry. There's a lot of people looking into different things. And that's fine. Most of the laws that are coming out are focused on addressing or additional penalties for corruption and for fraud and so on. We support that 100%. The most recent law was Congressman Price's law. He's from North Carolina, on expanding MEJA, the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, which is a law that applies to contractors working for the U.S. government abroad. And he expanded it to make sure it covers all contractors working for all government agencies, and we supported that. We supported his previous initiative in 2004 when MEJA was expanded beyond just Department of Defense contractors. But it just makes sense from our industry perspective to have that kind of accountability.
What would you have liked to have already in place so that it could have kept this incident with the 17 deaths in Iraq from occurring?
Well, I think there are rules. Essentially, the military has rules of engagement. The civilians have rules for use of force, and the military has been very careful to keep a thick line between them. Essentially, if you're in the soldier, you have the rules of engagement, which are aggressive. They're secret. They allow you to be proactive in terms of your use of force so that you can accomplish your mission. But the security contractors, who are mostly, you know, the ones we're talking about in terms of Blackwater, are bodyguards, and they have something very separate called the rules for use of force, which allows them to defend themselves, defend whatever's in their contract, the thing they're protecting or the person they're protecting or whatever, and three, defend Iraqi civilians under mortal threat, and that's it. So it's a very different rules, and we think that's appropriate. Nevertheless, I think one thing that's not that people are not paying enough attention to is making sure that whatever the contracts are drawn up, whatever rules are drawn up, they fit within the larger mission. So essentially, we're trying to do reconstruction and redevelopment and so on in Iraq, and it just makes sense that whatever rules you create for the contractors, whatever they have to follow, doesn't undermine the larger mission with some of their operations. I mean, whatever happened, we don't know, but you know, it may, for all we know, they operated according to the rules that they had. I think the clients, which is say the government departments, have to be very careful how they draw these rules up and make sure that the companies do not undermine the larger mission.
Thank you very much, Doug Brooks with the International Peace Operations Association. Pervez Musharraf has been re-elected president in Pakistan after the Supreme Court refused to intervene on the issue of Musharraf's eligibility to run. Musharraf is a Bush administration ally who came to power in a military coup in 1999. As Devon Terriot Orr reports, the credibility of his election is in doubt, as more than 40% of eligible members of national and provincial parliaments who elect the president in Pakistan refuse to participate, with many resigning from parliament.
In Pakistan's 60-year history, it has had three constitutions and four military coups. Military rulers have been in the president's seat for half of the country's existence. The most recent of these, President General Musharraf, took control in a 1999 coup, vowing to root out corruption and to stay in power for a limited time. 8 years later, Musharraf remains in power. Supporters state that Musharraf's rule has led to economic stabilization, reduced corruption, the decentralization of power, and increased media freedom. But critics point to the detention of hundreds without charge in the U.S.-backed war on terror, electoral irregularities, lack of respect for the Constitution, and Musharraf's broken promise to resign from his army post in 2004. Under Pakistan's 1973 constitution, the president is elected by members of the provincial and national assemblies. Contrary to this requirement, Musharraf was elected as president by a national referendum in 2002. The vote, however, was marred by reports of physical abuse and intimidation, as well as vote rigging. The present assemblies, in which Musharraf's party has a majority, came to power in 2002 in elections that were similarly criticized as seriously flawed by independent observers. On November 15th, the assemblies will be dissolved, after which new assemblies must be elected by popular vote. It is widely expected that Musharraf's party will lose control of the assemblies in the upcoming general elections. Musharraf's bid to retain power remains hotly contested. Author and attorney Zulfikar Maluka summarizes the two constitutional hurdles obstructing Musharraf's re-election bid.
This constitution doesn't allow the present assemblies to elect Musharraf as a president for the next 5 years, number one. This constitution does not allow Musharraf to contest election in uniform use.
On Friday in Islamabad, the Supreme Court of Pakistan chose a middle ground. The court permitted the election to proceed, but held that the results cannot be ratified until the legal challenges are resolved. The Attorney General heralded the unanimity of the court's decision.
What is most important is that this is a unanimous decision. All the judges have said that we are not going to stay the election process. That must go on. What is important is that they have allowed the present assemblies to elect the president.
But opposition lawyer Tariq Mahmood cautioned that the underlying issues remain open and that Saturday's election results could be nullified.
The question of disqualification is open. The question whether these assemblies are competent to vote, that question is also open. And ultimately, if they come to the conclusion that he is disqualified, then as far as this election process is concerned, it would be null and void.
Whether the court nullifies the election results or not, the vote was marred by the resignations of 86 opposition members of parliament and by violent protests in the northwest frontier provinces, where police fired tear gas at protesting opposition lawyers and ran over one protester with an armored personnel carrier. Members of the largest opposition party, the Pakistan People's Party of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, merely abstained from voting but did not resign. The PPP's last-minute decision to participate in the elections came in the wake of the National Reconciliation Ordinance promulgated by Musharraf on Friday, which eliminates dozens of corruption cases, including those pending against Bhutto and her husband. The ordinance paves the way for Bhutto's return to Pakistan later this month from self-imposed exile. Over the weekend, Musharraf appeared in civilian clothes calling for calm and stating that Pakistan was transitioning from military to civilian rule. But many Pakistanis, such as Zaman Khan, feel that the election results represent nothing more than a continuation of army rule.
I feel helpless, you know, frustrated that I can't do anything because he has a gun in his hand. For the last 8 years, this turning point, and one doesn't know how long it will take.
Many fear that Musharraf will not respect an adverse decision from the Supreme Court. Musharraf has publicly taken a wait-and-see approach, neither saying that he will declare martial law nor stating that he will respect the decision. After the Eid holiday next weekend, the Supreme Court will continue to hear the petitions challenging the election, and a decision is expected by the end of the month. In Lahore, Pakistan, this is Devon Terrio Orr for Free Speech Radio News.
Today is Columbus Day, which is still a federally established national holiday. Over 500 Columbus Day protesters took to the streets in Denver to protest against the annual Columbus Day parade and to stop what they think is a colonialist holiday and celebration of mass destruction of indigenous peoples of North America. The protests included over 83 arrests. In 1907, Colorado was the first state to recognize Columbus Day as a holiday, but in recent years, protests have come to symbolize the event. Most of the arrested protesters will be charged with interfering with a parade route and interfering with a lawful assembly. Denver police also said some will be charged with resisting arrest. Blake Wesley was on the scene and has this report.
Columbus Day is not the story. Over 500 protesters marched through Denver carrying picket signs saying abolish Columbus Day and Christopher Columbus is America's first terrorist. Lahuta Indigenous human rights activist Russell Means says the holiday celebrates the oppression and genocide that indigenous people have endured since Columbus stumbled upon the Americas.
Why don't they have a national holiday to the Iroquois Confederacy, to the American Indian people who gave them the idea of individual liberty? Instead, they got a national holiday to a slave trading, the first transatlantic slave trader.
Protesters occupied an intersection where the official Columbus Day parade was scheduled to proceed and doused the street with fake blood and dismembered doll limbs. Glenn Morris, a prominent Native American activist and professor of political science at CU Denver, says Columbus Day is a celebration of genocide.
This is a racist parade. This is a hate speech parade. This parade celebrates the genocide of Native people. And that's why we're out here, because it constitutes ethnic intimidation and race hate.
Over 100 Denver police officers surrounded them and then began making arrests. Protesters formed a human chain, making it more difficult for the officers to arrest them.
Hurting me!
Stay in compliance, let's go.
Ow!
Just cooperate.
Evan Hersop, who works for Cop Watch, an organization that monitors police, says the police tactics were needlessly brutal.
I think they went way overboard. They went way too far out of hand. You know, they've just been kind of a little bit on the rough side with everybody all day. Been twisting a lot of arms and in ways that they don't need to and cause pain. I could tell they were causing pain.
Hersoff says the police tackled one protester and the protester started bleeding from the nose and mouth. When two Colorado street medics attempted to aid the man, the police officers refused.
Sure, a person that you arrested that might have a head injury is not going to get worse. That's a potentially life-threatening...
Once police succeeded in clearing the street, the parade was allowed to continue, and parade participants revved their Harleys at the protesters on the sidewalks, and a yelling match ensued. Columbus Day Parade spectator Greg Satrianos says the Columbus protesters have a right to protest, but he disagrees with them.
I don't know what the Indians are talking about, because Columbus was the one that discovered America, and if they don't want to live in America, then they can get out.
But Mike from the Lakota tribe says people don't understand what Columbus was really about.
This is a peace and dignity protest for our people, so that we can educate them on what Columbus was really all about. He brought over disease. He brought over slavery. He didn't free this country. He didn't discover a country that was already inhibited.
Free Speech Radio News, I'm Blake Wesley.
A temporary restraining order is preventing the Social Security Administration from sending out 140,000 no-match letters that would include new regulations issued by the Department of Homeland Security. The new regulations would hold employers responsible if employee names don't correspond with their Social Security numbers. While the aim is to crack down on unauthorized immigrant workers, business owners and documented workers could also be affected. Zoe Sullivan reports from New York.
The Department of Homeland Security issued new regulations in August, giving employers 90 days to correct non-matching Social Security numbers of their employees or face fines and criminal penalties. Approximately 8 million workers would be affected, 2 million of them in California alone. Previously, unresolved mismatches carried no consequences for employers. Russ Kanaki, spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security, explains why they issued the new regulations.
There was a lot of ambiguity associated with these no-match letters. The letters would indicate that there was a discrepancy in a name and Social Security number, but not provide any guidance to employers on what to do about it. Employers for years have felt this frustration. We put forward a regulation that eliminates that ambiguity and provides clear guidance for what to do if they're in receipt of a no-match letter, along with a safe harbor provision should they act responsibly within 90 days.
The DHS sees this as a way of cracking down on undocumented workers in the workforce and restoring the government's credibility around immigration enforcement. In 2006, however, the Social Security Administration's Office of the General Inspector reported that 17.8 million records contain discrepancies. 70% of these are due to clerical errors, not immigration status. One innocuous reason for a mismatch is marriage. Many women change their names when marrying, and this can produce a no-match letter if the Social Security Administration isn't notified. Alexandra Camacho, who changed her name when she became a U.S. citizen, discovered that her records were wrong when she went to renew her driver's license.
So when I went to Social Security,
I thought, okay, this is going to be an in-and-out thing also. The Social Security Administration person told me it would take anywhere between 4 to 6 weeks for me to get my card in the mail with my corrected name.
Cases such as Camacho's illustrate how much time it could take people to resolve these issues. Each trip to the Social Security Administration or other government offices is a day lost from work. The demand at Social Security offices in states with larger populations could also increase processing delays beyond the 90-day window in the regulation. DHS spokesperson Kanaki insists that disruptions will be minimal, but the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has testified that small businesses will be disproportionately penalized by this regulation. Given the importance that each person plays in a small business's productivity, time off to resolve a bureaucratic issue takes a larger toll on their operations. The Chamber of Commerce, the ACLU, the AFL-CIO, and others have brought a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security, saying that only Congress has the power to make this kind of change. 140,000 letters, each containing 10 or more names, are being held by the Social Security Administration because the court issued a temporary restraining order stopping the mailing. The restraining order expires on Thursday. Amy Sugimori, the executive director of La Fuente, says some employers abuse no-match letters to control their workforce.
The big concern, I mean, one very big concern is that employers are likely to abuse the process in ways that are either discriminatory or in many cases chilling of worker organizing or workers speaking up for their rights. I've heard of many cases in the past where employers will use a Social Security no-match as a pretext for firing or taking action against a worker because they were engaged in union organizing or because they were complaining about an on-the-job injury or unpaid wages or other violations. And this creates a chilling climate that's bad for all workers.
Business, labor, and immigrant advocates anxiously await Thursday's court decision. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Zoe Sullivan in New York.
Yesterday, the 17th annual Italian Peace March took place, which gathered 200,000 people from all over the country in solidarity with Burmese monks and the victims of all the Middle East wars. Diletta Varlese has more from Rome.
The nearly 15-mile peace march begins in the central Italian city of Perugia and ends in the town of Assisi, the home of Saint Francis of Assisi, who remains an important symbol of peace for lay people and Catholics in Italy. The march has taken place every year for 17 years and provides a space for all Italians who want to show their commitment to building peace in the world. This year, demonstrators march under the slogan "All Rights for All Humans." Flavio Lotti is a spokesperson for the Group for Peace.
Cercheremo di ricordare a tutti che cosa sono questi diritti umani. Quando noi parliamo di...
We want people to remember what human rights are, and we mean basic rights. Those rights that are not yet granted for all the people in the world. There's also a war that exists in our country, a mafia war that kills someone every day. With this march, we want to symbolically embrace the people who are suffering through mistreatment in Burma and in war. We gather to call for their rights to be respected.
This year, the main goal of the march was to highlight the violent repression in Burma and show solidarity with Buddhist monks and lay people there. A special memorial was also dedicated to Anna Politkovskaya, the Russian journalist whose murder occurred 1 year ago yesterday. A special speech was delivered in response to the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. At the end of the march, a last reflection was given by Andrea Olivero, president of one of Italy's most prominent peace groups.
What we bring back home is the strength to make brotherhood a reality, to have the courage to build solidarity, despite the power of interests that rule the world.
At the end of the meeting, the organizers renewed the call for next year's march and to work towards concrete changes. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Diletta Varlese in Brescia, Italy.
The United Nations General Assembly has adopted a non-binding declaration on the rights of indigenous peoples after 22 years of debate. What impact this will have on marginalized people around the world remains to be seen. Joshua Chalimpa reports on the obstacles still facing the Batwa of Uganda, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Around 600,000 Batwa lived in the forests of DR Congo, southwest Uganda, and Rwanda. They were first evicted in the 1970s after legislation outlawed hunting and gathering and introduced national parks, driving the Batwa communities off their ancestral lands. The Batwa had taken advantage of less than effective governments to reclaim their land, but were driven out again in 1991 when the governments of all three countries forcibly removed them to stop encroachment on the Bwindi, Gahinga and Virunga sanctuaries for the endangered mountain gorillas. Tears running down his face, Mahuka Isaac explains the suffering his community has endured.
Basically, he's saying they are just helpless people. They have no land, they have no shelter, they have no something like a plate to eat from, or even saucepans to cook from.
Yeah, I was
once staying in the forest, but when eviction took place, we were brought outside the forest.
The Batwa now live in fragmented settlements on handouts from well-wishers. Most have become beggars or landless laborers, working for neighbors for less than $1 a day. Zanika Penina is the coordinator of the United Organization for Batwa Development.
The Batwa were hunter-gatherers. They used to live in the forest, survive on the mushrooms, meat, and everything that they used to have from the forest. They were evicted in the year 1991, whereby the protected areas was established for the gorillas. After that, they were all scattered to survive on cheap labor while working on other people's land. The result, of course, was to have no land, no income-generating activity, and lack of access to the forest and benefit sharing from the forest.
At one of the camps on the slopes of the Exoro Hills in southwestern Uganda, Henry Bachirani, another of the organization's officials, hands a goat over to the community.
That goat will be taken care of by the whole community. When the goat multiplies or it produces, each person will be receiving one goat each. If they take care of it very well, then we are likely to ask any donor to give them more goats like we are doing in other communities. So it will depend how careful they take care of this goat.
More than a decade after being displaced, the Batwa continued to appeal to their governments and the international community to be allowed to return to their home. Speaking through an interpreter, Kazung Stephen, one of the Batwa leaders, appeals for help.
Briefly, he's saying he's appealing to the government of Uganda and the international community to help them and give them back land as a compensation. Because without land, they cannot live in happy life. They want to cultivate, they want to have houses, children want to go to school. So if children go to school, they get hungry and they cannot study very well. So if there is land and people can go to school, then there is some food for them. So we are strongly appealing to the government to give us land so that we can resettle.
The UN declaration is unlikely to lead to any quick victory for the Batwa. The international community is bent on efforts to conserve the mountain gorillas that shared home with the Batwa, and there is lack of effort on the side of their governments to restore their land rights. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa in Kisoro Hills on the borders of Uganda, DR Congo, and Rwanda.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. From KBCS in Bellevue, Seattle, I'm Yuko Kadama.